When Michael Booth discovered that his adopted homeland of Denmark had been named the happiest place on earth, he was bewildered. This dark, wet, flat country with stoic people, punishing taxes, and dull television seemed an unlikely candidate for global happiness champion. Yet Denmark and its Nordic neighbors consistently dominate international happiness rankings, with all five countries, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Iceland, regularly appearing in the top positions. The global fascination with Nordic exceptionalism has only intensified in recent years. Swedish crime novels sell millions, Danish TV shows like The Killing win international acclaim, Finland's education system is celebrated worldwide, and Norwegian oil wealth is the envy of nations. Even celebrities have joined the Nordic fever. Oprah visited Copenhagen to marvel at Danish happiness, while politicians from Barack Obama to David Cameron have looked to these countries for policy inspiration. But having lived among Scandinavians for over a decade, Booth recognized a more complex reality behind the perfect facade. Why weren't people flocking to live in these supposedly perfect societies? What explained the region's troubling rates of alcoholism, suicide, and racism? To uncover the truth behind the Nordic miracle, Booth embarked on a journey across all five countries, meeting historians, anthropologists, politicians, and even Santa Claus himself, to discover what makes these societies tick and whether their success contains lessons the rest of the world can apply. Denmark's consistent ranking as the world's happiest nation seems perplexing at first glance. This small, rainy country with the world's highest taxes hardly seems a paradise. Yet the secret to Danish happiness lies in several interconnected factors that create a uniquely satisfying way of life. The Danish work-life balance stands unrivaled globally. Danes work fewer hours than most Europeans, 1,559 annually versus the EU average of 1,749. And ranks second only to Belgians in what some might call laziness. Most finish work by 4 to 5 p.m., rarely work weekends, and essentially shut down the entire country during July for their summer house migration. Over 20% of working-age Danes receive unemployment or disability benefits, with their flexicurity system combining employer flexibility with generous safety nets. These summer houses represent another happiness factor, simple wood and brick hideaways where Danes unwind in flip-flops, grilling hot dogs, and drinking lager. Furnished with paperbacks, board games, and family artwork, they epitomize Danish leisure priorities. Unlike other Nordic countries with state alcohol monopolies, Denmark embraces drinking culture, selling alcohol in every shop. But Danish happiness isn't merely about leisure time. It emerged from centuries of trauma and loss. Once rulers of all Scandinavia under the Kalmar Union, Denmark suffered repeated humiliations and territorial losses to Sweden, Britain, and Germany. By the 19th century, Denmark had been reduced to a fraction of its former size. These losses proved transformative, binding Danes together more tightly than any other Nordic people. No longer a great European power, Denmark turned inward, developing remarkable self-sufficiency and learning to cherish simple pleasures. This national transformation coincided with Denmark's cultural golden age, when Hans Christian Andersen published his fairy tales, Soren Kierkegaard wrote his existentialist works, and artists like Bertel Thorvaldsen flourished. Modern Danish identity developed through several key events: the Constitution of 1849, the Great School Commission, creating one of Europe's first free nationwide primary school systems, and Grundtvig's folk high schools. The Gini coefficient, created by Italian statistician Corrado Gini in 1921, measures wealth distribution in a society as a simple figure between 0, perfect equality, and 1, maximum inequality. Many experts argue this metric reveals why more equal societies like the Nordic countries are healthier, happier, and have fewer social problems. Research shows that unequal societies like the U.S. and U.K. suffer more obesity, crime, drug abuse, and mental illness regardless of absolute wealth levels. Paradoxically, Denmark consistently ranks as the world's happiest country despite not being the most equal Nordic nation. Sweden typically holds that distinction. When questioned about this contradiction, Professor Richard Wilkinson suggested happiness surveys may be unreliable compared to objective health measures, where Danes actually fare poorly with the world's highest cancer rates and lowest Nordic lifespans. This raises an intriguing question. Once societies reach a certain threshold of equality, perhaps other factors become more important for happiness. The Gini coefficient may not be the complete explanation for Nordic exceptionalism after all. Danish society demonstrates extraordinary levels of social cohesion. A remarkable 43% of Danish adults belong to some organization, with the average Dane participating in three different groups. Their personal networks average 11.8 people compared to 8.7 for Britons. Denmark boasts 83,000 local and 3,000 national associations, ranging from leisure clubs to powerful trade unions, with the government actively supporting this social fabric through funding and facilities. Crucially, Danish social groups typically draw members from across the socioeconomic spectrum. Doctors play hockey with factory workers, academics join quiz teams with shop assistants. This interconnectedness correlates with extraordinary levels of trust. 88.3% of Danes express high trust in others, the highest globally, and 96% know someone they can depend on in need. Which came first, Denmark's high trust or its social cohesion? This chicken and egg question fundamentally divides Danish society and academic discourse. Two opposing camps have formed. The Ginis believe Denmark's remarkable trust stems from economic equality fostered by the welfare state's comprehensive wealth redistribution through progressive taxation and universal benefits. They point to Denmark's Gini coefficient, one of the world's lowest, as evidence that economic equality breeds social trust. The opposing monetarist camp, led by economist Christian Bjørnskov and others, argues Danes possessed exceptionally high trust levels long before the welfare state existed, citing pre-war sociological research from the 1930s that shows Danes were already unusually trusting people. Some scholars suggest Viking culture is the source of modern Danish egalitarianism, often referencing the famous story of Vikings laughing when asked to speak to their king, declaring, "We are all kings here." This narrative emphasizes the Norse tradition of thing assemblies, where freemen gathered to make collective decisions and settle disputes. However, this simplistic view ignores that Viking society had clear class divisions between rulers, middle-class farmers, and thrall slaves. While Vikings did have a strict code of honor and valued community cooperation for survival in harsh conditions, practicing collective farming and shared responsibility for defense, they were also notoriously violent raiders, a stark contrast to modern Danes' peaceful reputation. The welfare state argument suggests trust emerges directly from institutions creating equality of opportunity through universal health care, free education, and strong social safety nets. Proponents highlight how these systems reduce economic anxiety and class barriers, fostering social mobility and cooperation. However, similar welfare systems in other countries haven't produced comparable trust levels. The truth likely involves complex historical and cultural factors unique to the region that can't be easily replicated elsewhere. These include centuries of relative ethnic homogeneity, Lutheran religious traditions emphasizing collective responsibility, strong civil society institutions, and a history of consensual democracy. The transformation from Viking-era violence to modern trust may have been facilitated by medieval agricultural cooperatives, strong guild systems, and the folk high school movement that promoted democratic values and collective learning. Additionally, Denmark's experience with early democratic reforms and peaceful transitions of power may have contributed to establishing stable institutions that reinforce trust over generations. This suggests that while both equality and trust reinforce each other in contemporary Denmark, their relationship emerged through a distinctive historical process shaped by multiple interconnected cultural, political, and social factors. Denmark's economic model resembles a bumblebee. Conventional wisdom says a high-tax, large public sector system shouldn't work, yet somehow it flies. Despite world-leading tax rates, Danes rarely complain openly, though they actively participate in a tacitly accepted black market economy. Politicians turn a blind eye to this tax avoidance because cracking down would destroy small businesses that comprise 76% of Danish companies. Despite their Lutheran reputation for parsimony, Danes have the Western world's highest private debt-to-income ratio, 310%, more than double that of Portuguese or Spanish citizens, and quadruple that of Italians. This stems partly from calamitous interest-only mortgages introduced in 2003, which fueled a property boom followed by inevitable bust. Danes also save just 1% of annual income compared to the Western average of 5.7%. The Danish welfare state faces serious challenges. Its productivity levels have been lagging since the mid-90s, and research shows Danes are working fewer hours than they admit, fewer than 28 hours weekly. As economist Torben Trans puts it, there seems to be an inconsistency between how much we want to work and how much we want to have of the public sector. Even more concerning, some politicians hint taxes might need to increase further in the future. Alongside Denmark's egalitarian values, two powerful forces drive Danish conformism, Jantelov and Hygge. The Jantelov, articulated by writer Axel Sandemose in his 1933 novel, A Fugitive Crosses His Tracks, consists of 10 commandments of conformity that still haunt Nordic society. These rules essentially state, you're not to think you're special, and you're not to think you're better than us. Though most Danes claim Jantelov is declining, it remains deeply embedded in everyday life. Friends making pointed jokes about Mercedes purchases, neighbors gossiping about renovations deemed too luxurious, houses with swimming pools rejected as too ostentatious, and uncomfortable silences when someone mentions academic achievements or career success. Hygge, often translated simply as cozy, is actually a highly codified form of social interaction with strict rituals demanding conformity. While theoretically democratic and available to all who understand its rules, Hygge requires equal participation, living in the moment, and adherence to unwritten social codes. These include maintaining moderate lighting, preferably candles, avoiding controversial topics, sharing food and drinks equally, and ensuring no one person dominates the conversation. Anthropologist Jeppe Trolle Linnet notes Hygge acts as a vehicle for social control and implies negative stereotyping of social groups who are perceived as unable to create Hygge, particularly immigrants and those who don't instinctively understand its subtle rules. Similarly, anthropologist Richard Jenkins describes it as normative to the point of coercive, noting how the pressure to maintain Hygge can suppress authentic expression and conflict resolution. This desire for an unchallenging atmosphere connects to what scholars call the drawbridge theory. After losing their empire and experiencing multiple defeats to Germany, Danes turned inward, clinging to shared values and avoiding anything that might disturb social harmony. Though Danes pride themselves on informality and casual social interactions, they maintain highly ritualized social rules, particularly around celebrations and holidays. Birthday celebrations, Christmas traditions, and even weekly family dinners follow precise, unwritten protocols that everyone is expected to know and follow. This creates a paradoxical culture that is simultaneously informal in appearance but rigid in its social expectations, where breaking these unspoken rules can lead to subtle but real social consequences. The interplay between Jantelov and Hygge creates a unique social environment where individual achievement is downplayed while collective comfort is elevated to an art form. This has both positive effects, fostering social equality and community cohesion, and challenging ones, potentially stifling innovation and individual expression in ways that modern Denmark increasingly grapples with in an increasingly globalized world. Are Danes truly the happiest people in the world, or are they telling porkies in a land of 12 million pigs? When defining happiness, Danes aren't claiming heel-kicking joie de vivre, but rather contentment with their lot. Yet few Danes seriously believe they're the global happiness champions. They appreciate their welfare state, functional society, and free time, but approach their vaunted happiness like victims of a practical joke. Perhaps the secret lies in low expectations. When Danes are asked about their expectations for the coming year, they typically expect less than others. When these modest expectations are met, they feel fulfilled. Danish happiness might actually be contentedness, appreciating small joys after a turbulent history of loss. Professor Kare Christensen's study, Why Danes Are Smug, suggested their happiness stems from consistently low expectations. Year after year, they are pleasantly surprised to find that not everything is getting more rotten in the state of Denmark. The Danish language reflects their relaxed approach, with phrases like slap off, relax, rolly nu, easy now, and put med day, don't worry about it. Denial is another key to Danish happiness. They deny the costs of being Danish, both financial, high taxes, expensive goods, and spiritual, lack of ambition, loss of individualism through Jantelag and hygge. They're in denial about their poor health, creaking public services, gang criminality, integration challenges, economic divide, and various economic woes, including low productivity and massive public sector spending. Iceland might seem an odd inclusion among Nordic countries. Even Icelanders might argue this point. After all, the country was founded by people fleeing Scandinavia, is geographically closer to North America, and trades more with Germany, the US, and UK than with Nordic nations. The country's financial misadventures were spectacular. Elton John performing single songs at birthday parties, private jets used like taxis, extravagant whiskey purchases, and parties at London's Natural History Museum featuring Tom Jones. When Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008, Iceland's debts were exposed, around 850% of GDP compared to the US's 350%. The krona plummeted to half its value, with banks lending money to shareholders to buy shares in those same banks. Economic commentator Michael Lewis traced the economic crash directly to the introduction of fishing quotas in the early 1980s. Originally implemented to discourage risky fishing behavior after several bad seasons, the quota system took a fateful turn in 1991, when fishermen were permitted to trade quotas and use future catches as collateral for loans. These fishermen-turned-bankers went rogue, despite warnings from foreign economists. Iceland's relationship with Denmark reveals much about its place in the Nordic family. For centuries, Iceland's intellectual class was educated in Copenhagen, which remains a crucial cultural metropolis for Icelanders. This ambivalent relationship sheds light on Iceland's bizarre investment spree of 2006-2008, when Icelandic businessmen bought Copenhagen's main department stores, the Hotel d'Angleterre, Danish media companies, and Sterling Airline. These economically questionable purchases suggest a form of post-colonial revenge. Norway's transformation from dirndl-wearing peasants to dirndl-wearing Rockefellers began with the 1969 discovery of enormous North Sea oil reserves. This black gold has shaped contemporary Norwegian society more than any other factor, funding its welfare state, unparalleled standard of living, and strong regional infrastructure. With just over 5 million people, Norway now possesses the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, $395 billion, conservatively estimated to reach $1,000 billion by decade's end. Unlike Denmark, which granted sole oil concession rights to A.P. Møller - Mærsk through opaque deals, Norway established state-owned Statoil in 1972 and maintained firm control over production, handling its wealth fund with remarkable restraint. The oil fund represents modern Norway's greatest achievement, the ultimate expression of Nordic self-discipline and responsible fiscal stewardship envied worldwide. This brilliantly managed wealth fund now owns shares in over 8,000 companies, effectively giving Norwegians ownership of over 1% of the world's listed companies, almost 2% of Europe's and 0.7% of Asia's. Rather than exhibiting pride about their wealth, Norwegians remain cautious, mindful of avoiding Dutch disease, the economic malaise that can destroy competitiveness when natural resource wealth dominates an economy. Despite their prudent management, oil wealth has indeed corrupted Norway. Norwegians now work 23% fewer hours annually than before the oil boom, take more holidays, claim more sick leave, topping European rankings, and retire earlier, 63.5 years. An OECD report concluded that oil wealth had distorted the relationship between work and free time. About a third of working-age Norwegians do nothing at all, with over a million living on state money, while nearly 10% of Norwegian jobs are performed by foreigners doing work Norwegians avoid. Finland straddles one of the world's key cultural fault lines between Christianity and Orthodoxy, creating a nation forever torn between its Swedish and Russian influences. This duality has shaped the Finnish psyche into a complex tangle of contradictions. They're warm-hearted yet solitary, hard-working but seemingly slow to react, freedom-loving yet self-restricting. The Finns are essentially defined by what they leave unsaid, with numerous cultural taboos stemming from their complex history. Their relationship with the Swedes, anxieties about Russians, social inadequacies, drinking problems, the Civil War, Nazi collaboration, and economic fears. The Finnish relationship with alcohol is deeply problematic. Unlike Danes who drink socially and frequently, Finns approach alcohol with singular determination, drinking not for rapid intoxication rather than pleasure. Finland's education system has become its most celebrated post-Cold War achievement, consistently ranking at or near the top of the OECD's International Educational Ranking since 2000. What's remarkable isn't just Finland's excellence, but how it achieves these results without the expected ingredients of educational success. Finnish schools spend only the OECD average per student. Children don't start formal education until age 7, face minimal testing before 16, receive little homework, and spend just 4 hours daily at school. What truly distinguishes Finland's system is its consistency across the country. There's just 4% performance variance between the best and worst schools. Whether in remote Lapland or Helsinki, educational quality remains constant. This equality stems from a rigorously enforced curriculum and one-on-one tutoring for struggling students. Teaching in Finland enjoys extraordinary prestige, dating back to the nation's independence when teachers served as intellectual freedom fighters, candles of the people lighting the path to Finnish self-reliance. Sweden represents the largest, 9.3 million people, most successful, and undoubtedly most influential Nordic country. As Finnish historian Laura Kolbe noted, Sweden functions like a sun or magnet to which all Nordic peoples have been drawn over the last half millennium. It's the elder brother, the role model, the most successful society the world has ever known. Despite the brotherly front these nations present through Nordic unions and councils, deeper investigation reveals persistent animosity toward the Swedes from their neighbors. Whether it's Danish resentment of IKEA's success, Norwegian jokes about Swedish immigrant workers, or Finnish murmurs about homo Swedish men. Sweden's boldest social experiment has been multiculturalism. Nearly 15% of Swedes were born outside the country, compared to 6% in Denmark, and including the next generation, almost a third of the population has foreign roots. The world has also looked to Sweden for guidance on handling banking crises, as Sweden successfully navigated its own credit bubble burst in the early 1990s through public sector reforms and privatization while preserving its welfare state core. Swedish ethnologist Åke Dahn explains that Swedes have a heightened fear of appearing foolish and strive to be duktig, diligently competent, and lagom, moderate, reasonable, fair. This concept of lagom supposedly dates back to Vikings sharing mead around campfires, each taking care not to drink too much before passing the cup to their neighbor. Lagom defines many aspects of Swedish society, from inconspicuous consumption patterns to their consensus-based government. Despite my attempts to find fault with the happiest, most trusting, and successful people on the planet, I acknowledge that the Nordic countries, despite their flaws and challenges, remain enviably rich, peaceful, harmonious, and progressive. They offer a viable alternative to both rampant capitalism and Soviet socialism. Even Iceland is recovering with higher growth than most of Europe. The Nordic nations, though appearing similar, are fascinatingly diverse with different genetic roots, mentalities, histories, and economic systems. Some have oil and gas, others trees or hot air. Their economic arrangements differ, as do their relationships with the EU. A key to Nordic happiness is autonomy, the ability to determine one's own destiny. These countries consistently show the highest levels of well-being precisely because they offer the greatest equality of educational opportunity and social mobility. Unlike the American dream, in Scandinavia, social mobility is reality. These are the true lands of opportunity, where people have freedom to be themselves, without judgment, as long as they wait for green lights. The bedrock of Nordic exceptionalism is high-quality, free education available to all. Though integration of immigrants remains challenging, with non-European immigrants in Sweden actually seeing declining relative incomes, progress is happening. Denmark appears to be leading integration efforts, with immigrants more spread throughout society rather than segregated. Looking forward, some advocate for a proper Nordic Union with joint military, foreign policy, and currency. With 25 million people combined, such a union would carry significant global weight, though it remains unlikely. The Nordic countries have already shown they can get things right without any blood being spilled, a model for the future, even if their particular formula for success cannot be perfectly replicated elsewhere.